Hey, coach. Welcome to the Basketball Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Oliver. Let's share the game.
Basketball Immersion has grown, and I'm happy to say we can now support other coaches in providing access to their intellectual property. We created BIVideoProductions.com to support the game, to help us all learn the game to deeper and deeper levels through our BIVideoProductions.com platform. On BIVideoProductions.com, you can now find all access practices for Doug Novak and Dave Smart, full clinic videos for Best in the West Clinic featuring Alex Sarama, Mike McKay, and Jorik Michaels, and Aaron Fearns tagging up offensive rebounding system. Go to BIVideoProductions.com for more details and all these videos and what is coming soon. Wonderful to have Coach Joe Abunazer with us. Joe has been a trainer, speaker, clinician, and mentor in our game for 20 plus years. He is the founder of Impact Basketball, which most famously becomes the home of countless NBA players in their offseason workouts. Thousands of NBA, college, high school, and international pros and players have trained with Joe at Impact. It's really cool to have him here with us to talk about player development and the integration of all the different things that they do at Impact, which I know it's something that he's helped pioneer. Joe, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Chris.
Coach, let's just start where I just ended there, which is talking a little bit about integration of training. And this is something that I believe you pioneered a lot in the basketball player development system. And can you talk about what you mean by integrating training?
Sure. I mean, when I started doing this, you know, I was coaching in college I was a manager for Knight in Indiana until 93 and then coached for 4 years. And when I got out of it and started doing what I'm doing now, which was a smaller version of it at that time. And really the pitch or the hook that I had was I did not believe that guys or coaching staff were spending enough time really developing the overall player, you know, the full player. And my background in strength and conditioning, nutrition, you know, really, you know, kind of brought all that to light and thinking, you know, these guys aren't fit enough. They're not eating right. So when I first started training guys back in 97, which was Billups and Garnett and my first pros, that was our main focus. And, you know, we spent a ton of time on the basketball skills, but we spent an equal amount of time making sure that their nutrition was right, making sure that they were taking care of their bodies. They were strong enough. They had great flexibility. We talked to coaches all the time about you're in practice and you're telling a guy to get low or you're telling him to do specific things and, you know, his or her body can't move that way. So there's just work to be done outside of shooting the ball or outside of, you know, dribbling the ball, which of course are essential elements to the game. But that was my deal. That was my way to get through to guys, you know, getting them to eat better, you know, changing guys' bodies. And what they found is that everything they did on the court became better. So that was the model that we followed. And it's still to this day, you know, people say, what is different about what you do, you know, at Impact or what is different in general? And the answer, simple answer to that is we just don't find there's anyone that can combine all the different elements like we can and put the special emphasis on it, you know, and that goes also for the mental preparation part, you know, getting guys understanding how to prepare for games, how to prepare for training, how to get into a routine. So we tell young kids all the time, you know, if you want to be a player, it's a lot more than just getting drills together. So when we talk about, you know, integrating everything, that's the attention. We basically call it four pillars. The basketball piece, of course, skills, which is critical, the strength, conditioning, speed, agility, the different things that are important to the day-to-day in the game today being the second. The third being that nutritional piece, which we have, you know, we have great partners at Herbalife that do a lot of research and, you know, different things that we can improve the way guys not only just look, but how they feel, their energy levels. And then that fourth piece, which is critical, is the whole mental approach to both training and playing.
It's great stuff. And, you know, in this day and age, I think most coaches understand the value of all these different pieces. But the reality is, and I want you to put on your high school coaching hat a little bit, because I know you deal with that demographic as well, with what you can do with your resources, what do you feel, let's first start with, what do you feel some of the things that high school coaches or coaches at those levels aren't doing enough of in terms of integrating things that they can, even without resources?
Well, I think that, you know, I have an interesting perspective on it because, you know, I'm heavily involved in high school basketball because my son is a freshman in college now. So he just finished, but, you know, since he was in the fourth and fifth grade, I've coached his teams, helped at his high school. You know, he played at a pretty high level of high school basketball, and I'm integrated. And even today, I'm helping at a local program here and trying to figure that exact question out. And I think the biggest thing, Chris, I think is that the coaches, you know, during the season, your time is limited, your gym time is limited, your staff is limited. You know, you don't have four assistants that are, you know, so if you do, they might be coming from different jobs, and some are there some days. I get it. I think the off seasons are misused a lot in high school basketball. I think there's just a huge commitment to playing in summer leagues and fall leagues and just playing, and not enough time is spent on getting your players better. So, you know, that player who got pushed out of the way in the semifinal game of the league tournament, you know, who needs to put on an extra 5-8 pounds of muscle, you know, he spends the whole summer playing games, and now next year he's still getting pushed out of the way and you're still losing the game. So, you know, the guys who can't pass with both hands, the guys who just aren't good enough shooters. I mean, we're seeing how important shooting is in the game today with the way it's moving. And I just think that there's a lot to be done in the off season that isn't done. And I think it's because, you know, look, I was a coach. I mean, we want to work on our press. We're worried about, I mean, for coaches to be worried about the flow of their offense in June, you know, it's a little bit comical to me, because, you know, just get guys better in June. If you can't get your offense together in September, October, and ready to play in November, then you got other issues to deal with, right? So I think that, you know, putting guys in situations, you know, even if you don't have resources and you're playing guys in different positions in the summer games, looking at different, you know, making guys do more than they're used to doing, you know, setting time aside and canceling, you know, that team camp for a week when you just do a development series, you know, bring in, everyone has access to strength and conditioning things. I mean, even if you have mini bands and you know, a very basic weight room, you know, on our online program that we put out there, we have our strength and conditioning section is assuming you have very limited, you know, weight rooms. You don't have our weight room, of course, and some do. Some schools are lucky to have it. But I think, you know, really spending the time figuring out how to get guys better in the off season. And then during the season, allocating just a small amount of time and practice to kind of fine tuning, you know, and getting shots up, and not, hey, come in after practice today, we're going to shoot for 20 minutes, but making it a focal part of your practice to really drill hard. You know, you work your zone hard, you work your man offense hard, you work your plays hard, you're running 5-on-0, and then guys split up the buckets and shoot at 50% of their game speed. You know, those are the type of things I think coaches can do a better job of without any resources at all.
Great stuff. And we're going to circle back to a lot more of the offseason and even some of the things you raised there. It's going to be good to dive deep with that with you. But one thing that came through as I prepared for this was just how many times I saw the word simple associated with your workouts. And I imagine that's actually a compliment to you.
It is. Yeah. I mean, look, our kind of our new tagline is we actually train basketball players, you know, and if you break down, I can't tell you how many guys have come and watched our workouts and say, oh, you know, I think they're expecting to see, you know, some sort of crazy drills or, you know, things. I mean, what we do is here's the thing with player development. You watch a game, you figure out the movements that guys are making in the game, and you repeat them in a workout and improve them. It's not complicated. So, you know, you don't want guys taking 6 dribbles, right? So why would you do a drill where you're dribbling around a chair, picking up a cone, putting the cone down? I mean, those are the type of things, we just don't do them. And we're constantly breaking down real basketball and making players better within that system, because nobody plays a game, you know, 1-on-0, of course. And we just really simplify. It's about footwork. You know, guys with good footwork, if you look at the best players in the NBA, other than, you know, a few guards, Chris Paul, Kyrie Irving, those kind of guys that dribble a lot, you know, Harden, those type of players. There aren't a lot of guys that are just dribble, you know, off of this. You know, there's certain pick and roll actions that you have to dribble off of, but we're limiting dribbles. You know, we're finding ways for guys to be more efficient. And with that comes the word simplicity. So if your feet aren't set, you're not going to make the shot. If you're, you know, if you just don't have fundamentals in your passing and the different really small aspects of the game, you're not going to be a good player. So we try every year to even get simpler. You know, what's the use of doing... There's an element of trainers today. You know, we all know that there's trainers everywhere, right? And there's, you know, from a, I'll give you an interesting example. And obviously I've grown up in the basketball world and never been away from it. And my son, who's a freshman, you know, he had the benefit of freshman college of my knowledge of the game. Well, my second son is a theater guy. He's a junior in high school, and I have no idea. You know, I couldn't tell if the theater coach was good, not the coach, you know, the teacher, but if we took him to a trainer, you know, he does voiceover work and he does, you know, different acting and singing. I don't know. I don't have the field navigated. So I'm comparing that to most parents, you know, who, without my, of course, knowledge or even a basketball coach's knowledge, that can't really distinguish between what's really important to train and not important to train. And my advice to all of them would be just keep it simple. You know, if it's shooting the ball, it's handling the ball, it's limiting dribbles, you know. And again, I'll come back to footwork a million times. I mean, it's the basis of anyone's game. So yeah, I love the fact that we're simple. You know, we try to be as simple as possible. And we'll tell people, look, you're going to learn how to play basketball here. You're not going to learn a drill sequence with 7-8 different things in it, because you're never going to do that in the game. You know, I've said all the time that coaches will really say, you know, we got to stop dribbling the ball so much in our offense. We got to move it. We got to have ball reversal. You know, you kill the play when you dribble too much. But if you watch kids train, they're over dribbling on every repetition. So yeah, that's why we really go for the simple part of it.
Well, and I'm wondering what the difference is between, say, let's move away from an NBA workout and a youth development or high school level player. Is there more ball handling incorporated there because we want them to get overall more comfortable with the ball and more comfortable, as you already said, with passing? There's a difference between those two levels, I imagine.
Oh, absolutely. There's no question that a trainer, any good trainer, would incorporate 15 minutes of good ball handling drills. No doubt about it. Yeah, I don't mean, like, even in our video series, you know, dribbling around chairs or cones or whatever, just to get a handle, getting your left hand strong, right hand strong. Absolutely. 100%. So, but that to me is, those are the building blocks of once you get up. So, but the drills where they're over dribbling within a sequence of a half court offense type thing, that's maybe more what I'm referring to. Absolutely, Chris. Yeah. You got to work on the ball handling. I mean, the two ball, I mean, we don't do a lot of two ball handling with pro guys, of course, because by that time they can usually do it. But of course, if you have a young player trying to get his left hand stronger or right hand stronger, there's no doubt that those kind of fundamental drills are critical. Yeah, so I agree. They're overhandling the ball in those particular drills, no question about it. But it's still, so if you break, we always say we break the player down from the court backwards. So if you watch even a sixth grader play and he's having trouble dribbling or he's having trouble shooting the ball from distance or whatever, that's how you structure his or her drill work. So yes, of course, I'm glad you pointed that out, is that there is a place for those ball handling drills or, you know, high level shooting reps, those type of things to build the fundamental blocks of a young player.
Well, that's great. And we're going to go back and forth between the two. So I just wanted to clarify what you were saying. Again, I had seen some of your stuff. I certainly have seen some of your workouts, and then understand where you're approaching it from a pro player's perspective and a youth player's perspective. Is totally different. But let's take it as a blanket question here. Is there a perfect technique for you in terms of starting from the base level? So building a player from scratch, is there a perfect technique to, let's say, shooting or footwork, the two areas where people get into? Or is it all, as you said, more specificity towards the individual and their anatomy and biomechanics and things like that?
I think there is a base and then there's some alterations from it. So what we've done is, you know, I've had, if you talk about pro guys, I've had guys like Garnett, Tayshaun Prince, Chauncey Billups, Kyle Lowry. They all shoot the ball very differently in their upper body. What's similar is, and Kyle's a great example, because when he first came to the Grizzlies, Jerry West, who drafted him, you know, used to tell me all the time, his footwork is terrible. He's never on balance. His feet are too close. So I think the common denominator in all of them is the footwork to me is should be the same for a pro as it is for a fifth grader. No question. And what that means is always on balance, you know, hips square to the rim when you're shooting the ball. You're not going to make a shot if your hips aren't square to the rim. You're not going to make a shot if you're leaning to you could make one, but not consistently, you know, if you're leaning to your left and right. So our blanket statement with that is that the footwork is kind of non-negotiable. And then from there we build, we're not going to change a guy's, you know, KG shot the ball so far behind his head. You know, obviously we had Kawhi Leonard for the draft and he shot the ball very well in the draft. And he just had a small little tweak to move his, to not bring it so far behind his head from college. And that's, you know, but the footwork is always the same. You know, we always tell guys, you should take a picture of a guy shooting. You should never know what happened before that, because their feet should always look the same when they shoot it. So, but again, it's not just shooting the ball. It's footwork. If you're getting ready to pass, you know, you talk about triple threat positions and the fundamentals that young kids are teaching. So I believe if I have a young player, that the first thing I'm establishing is his or her footwork. And then we work from there in terms of kind of customizing. Again, some people just shoot the ball a little bit. Tayshaun shoots it weird. You know, he's a pretty good shooter, but you know, Billups has that textbook, you know, and Lowry, the little elbow under shot, and some people shoot a little bit differently, but the footwork is always the same.
Right. It's a great point that it all starts from the feet ultimately. And that's a place that we should start from. But then the other part that goes with this, which I think is a common problem amongst all coaches, is that we spend too much time on simple and not enough time on integration of skill within, as you said already, game speed or game decisions, or, you know, again, even maybe one-on-one if we're talking about workouts and stuff like that. So what's your general guidelines for progressing skill from, say, doing, you know, let's say jump stop pivot pass to integrating it more within game situation?
I think that it's a careful balance. I think that you're right. I think it's sometimes a little bit too much of, too much drill. And I'm the 25 years, I've seen more guys who are what we call drill all Americans and couldn't play. Right. And I know that's kind of what you're referring to, is these guys that they, not just from any level, you know, they can drill, and then you get them in the game and you're like, oh boy. So I think it's a careful progression, but you know, again, we're constantly breaking the game down. So we're putting guys in 3-on-3 situations, 1-on-1 situations, you know, even when we do our drill work, we're guarding, you know, I mean, we have, like, you know, whether it's an intern or another player guarding, just so we can see the live reality of what's actually happening, but then we're breaking it down. So we might take, you know, a player and do some 3-on-3s in the morning and just take notes, you know, just understand, you know, coach him during it, but, you know, talk about footwork and decisions. And then that afternoon we might bring him back and say, wow, his feet were really off. So then we just do like an individual session where we're really working on those movements where he's getting his feet set and on balance. So I think it's a careful combination of that. And I think you're right. I think a lot of coaches, I think it has to do with what time of the year it is too. You know, that's something we're very big on, is the periodization of it. You know, the 15, 20 minutes of just those fundamental drills. A lot of coaches do it before every practice. You know, even when I was at Indiana, we did the four corner passing, and you know, it was the same routine every day, just to get the guys' hands warm. And there might be a different, you know, later in the season, you might not need as much of that. You might need a little more of the live action. So I think it's a really interesting combination of continually making it reality in basketball and then breaking it down from there. Because there are certain things that players need to just work 1-on-0 on. You know what I mean? If it's a release problem with the shot, or it's a footwork problem, you got to back them out of the competition and just work on it and just drill it, because nobody can argue that repetition is what's going to cause, you know, constant improvement. So I think coaches have to get a really good idea of how much of each to do. And with us, we have the luxury of having players in our gym a lot. You know, so if I was a high school coach and only had guys a certain amount of time, I would make sure to be very careful as to how much to spend on each of them, because what you don't want to do is have them repeating something the wrong way in a competition setting, but you also don't want to make them a drill guy, you know, so where they're only good doing it in the drills. So it's a very good point, Chris, and a very good something to think about from all levels of how much to balance on each.
Another thing that I love your phrasing of so many things that I've heard you say. So I want to kind of find out how you phrase this, because to me, player development, especially if we're talking about in an off season, is selfish time for a player. It's the time for them to get as skilled as possible, to focus on them and not focus on the team and their role within the team. And it's the coach's job to sort out your role once you get back to the team. So have you found a great way to phrase that to players, to parents, in terms of player development, about this is your time to get as skilled as possible? Because I'm sure you sometimes get the resistance as well, where a player will say, oh, well, my coach won't let me do that. Well, of course, fine. Yeah. This isn't about your coach. This is about you getting as good as you can.
Well, it's also why a lot of coaches want to keep their players with them all year, right? So no one's putting wild ideas in their head. You know, coaching is being on both sides of the game. You're hired to win. And sometimes the development of your individual players is what contradict with winning, right? So if you have a guy that's a screener or something and you just want to keep him screening, you're thinking, you know, he's doing a great job doing that. But that individual player wants to work on a shot. He wants to get better because that's the way to go. So I think that you know, it's a tough one for coaches I just think in the off season, you have to take as a program, you have to, as a coach leading a program, you have to take an approach that it might not look pretty right away. And, you know, we're all coaches when we started. So when you go to a summer league game and your team looks bad because you're trying different things, it's not easy to sit there and watch it. I get it. But I think that that's when you really have to understand what you're building for. So I would calendar it up and say, look, for the month of June, we're just doing personal stuff. You know, we're focused on, I just don't see, Chris, how coaches wouldn't be able to, or wouldn't have to agree that if all five guys on the floor were more versatile, quicker, better shooters, better passers, better ball handlers, how could your offense not be better? You know, and that's, I think, what you have to phrase to coaches is like, take a little time to make each of your pieces better. You know, all five of them or 10 of them or however many are going to play. And then I promise you, it's like, trust me, your offense will be better. And you can pull the reins back. You don't want every guy taking threes. You know, I get it. You don't want every guy doing this and doing that. And certain players, especially at a high school level where you don't have, you know, you're not recruiting players for the most part in most high schools, that you got guys that are limited in certain areas. But I think it's to the coaches, it would be to their benefit to develop every guy. I just, again, I don't want to keep going back to the off season, but you know, the high school season's ending right now. It's like, so let's say it ends March 15th, like between March 15th and June 1, if I'm a high school coach, I don't really care what my offense looks like. I mean, that's a, you know, the whole month of April and May and two and a half months where I'm spending getting all my guys better, you know. And the other thing too that it does is that the players like that, right? So now it adds, nobody wants to run shell drill in April, you know what I mean? And that's like, you know, that's the, I'm on the player side of it now, right? So I am too, coach. Yeah, I'm on the player side. So it's like, who the heck wants to work on shell drill in April? And really, even if you nail it in April, it doesn't mean it's going to translate in December. You know what I mean? So just drop the shell drill and, you know, forget about helpline principles and all that kind of thing. Put the coaching videos down of, you know, pack line defense and all that, and just figure out how you're going to get every single player better. The one thing coaches don't understand is that you'd be surprised how excited kids are to come to practice when they think you're there to get them better, right? So in our gym, people will tell you the atmosphere is so, even our draft guys coming from a, you know, top college programs will say, I just love coming here every day because everyone's trying to get me better. You know what I mean? And you know, we've all been in coaching. That's not always the feeling from players or even coaches. You're trying to win. So I think creating that atmosphere in the off season solves a lot of problems for coaches. And it also keeps, now when you do shell drill in September, it's not, you know, guys aren't rolling their eyes like, here we go again. So I think it is important. You can't worry about guys' roles and responsibilities. I would tell my players, and again, I do coach some in high school. I'd say, listen, you got from now until September. And then once we get rolling in, you know, into September and October, that's when I define my roles and responsibilities. I mean, you have 6 months to prove to me that you could be our premier 3-point shooter. You know, how much work do you want to put in to do that? So, you know, I just think that that's a huge benefit for the coaches. And I'd love to see more of them, you know, take that approach in the off season.
Well, that's great. And I do want you to talk about the off season. And that's, I think, one of the values of having you here is that you can really shed some light on some of these ideas that you're sharing. And periodization for coaches that don't know is just systematic planning of athletic or physical training, or, you know, in your case, obviously incorporating skill as well. So when we're talking about periodizing, you already talked a little bit about that first month and what you would do, but let's even go back further. Season just ends. What are some of the best practices now that you're sharing with people for active recovery or recovery after a season? Because that's where I think a lot of kids don't take any time either to be able to do the recovery phase.
Well, what they're doing is it's not only the coach doesn't always have control, because as soon as the season's over, their club season's starting, and then the parents are seeking out trainers, and, you know, the kid who didn't play enough minutes is now, you know, going crazy. So I can understand the frustration of the high school coaches, because in that spring season, you know, now even in California where we live, I mean, the clubs are all kicking out their tryouts and, you know, kids are looking forward to that season. So I think that the first thing, Chris, is rest. You know, I mean, I think that that's over underrated, you know, in terms of there is active recovery. There's from foam rolling to cryo chambers to ice baths to all the things you can do. But rest is huge, you know, and I think that players need to take a little time, you know, a week or two, and just do nothing, you know, and not eat bad and all that kind of stuff, but just keep their nutrition up and just keep active and let things. You know, I'm a triathlete, so you know I like to run what we call run through injuries. But there's a certain time where you just got to let it heal. You know, no matter what you're taking, no matter what you're putting on it, things have to heal. So after the course of a season, you have micro tears in your tissues and things that kids, you know, these guys are playing hard, practicing hard, and they need to take a little time off. And from there, I would build it. Obviously, you know, club basketball in the spring is great. I'm not like an anti AAU guy or anything. I think it's great to play. I think that parents have to understand and kids have to understand that you should have a plan, right? So if I were the high school coaches, I would sit with the families and I'd have a calendar and I, you know, not discourage them from all the other things, but just plan it correctly. So how many workouts are you getting a week? And, you know, because the body cannot be at peak levels for 12 months. So if I'm a high school coach, and again, I know the high school coaches battle this because some kids take the AAU season more importantly than their high school season, which is a whole nother problem, right? But you know that you have to look and say what is best for the player. So you can't peak yet, you know, in 12 months out of the year. So right now, I for example, I can tell you my son. So when we, you know, June and July were very busy months for him because June is all high school basketball. And then July is right into the traveling and playing at a high level that way. So, you know, we took time off and then we really gradually, you know, I would have him work on things that he really needed to work on. So whether it be 3-point shooting, but without all the running. So that's the thing that trainers can't equate progress with like sweating. Like you don't have to kill a kid every time he comes to a workout. So, you know, we might have some workouts with our guys where we're just shooting for an hour. You know, we're just going to work on footwork and release for an hour. So I would really put a calendar out, understand what your game load is. And again, I would encourage high school coaches to limit their games in June. In California, you can play in June. I don't know if that's, I'm sure that's not everywhere, but you know, so there are some coaches that are playing 3-4 games a week for the whole month of June and practicing on the other day. So it's a lot of basketball, you know, and then this kid leaves and then they're going to give him like a week or two off in August and expect him to just pick up. And, you know, coaches in California, the schools start middle of August. So coaches are starting, you know, second, third week of August, and then they're still going today, right? It's a lot of battling on the body. So I think the really important thing is to be organized in the off season to write down some key areas of improvement. If it's a kid who needs to gain strength, then that coach, parent, kid, trainer, whoever's involved has to understand that you're going to have to give up some cardiovascular conditioning in order for that kid to focus on strength. If it's a kid that needs to get leaner, lose weight, then it's a flip side of it. He's going to have to, you know, really do a little more cardiovascular conditioning in those off season months. Like, you know, with Kyle Lowry, what we 5 years ago or whatever, when he lost maybe 15, 18 pounds in the off season, he's kept it off and it changed. He's been a 6-time All-Star since. You know, we took the first 2 months and only did non-impact weight, not weight loss, but cardiovascular stuff, elliptical trainers, different things, because he had to change his body. So we didn't touch a basketball until June 1, which of course he doesn't need to be ready till October. So many people would say, wow, he didn't take that long time off. But the change he made to his body, you know, put him in the All-Star game 6 times in a row and he's got a nice ring to go with it. So, you know, those are the kind of plans that we help players put together. And I think that needs to be done to coordinate the offseason.
Hey, Coach, going to interrupt this podcast for a brief message from show partner, SimpliSafe. With home security, there's 2 ways you can go about protecting your home. There's the traditional way, where you wait weeks for a technician to do a messy installation that costs a small fortune. Or there's the other way, SimpliSafe. SimpliSafe is everything you need in a home security system. It's award-winning protection, 2-time winner of CNET Editor's Choice Award. SimpliSafe blankets your whole home in safety. You get comprehensive protection for your entire home. Outdoor cameras and doorbells alert you to anyone approaching your home. Entry, motion, and glass break sensors guard inside. You barely notice it's there. But what's truly remarkable is you can set up this system all by yourself. Anyone can do it. It takes 30 minutes to an hour tops. And there's absolutely no trade-offs to your safety. You'll have an army of highly trained security experts ready to dispatch police to your home at a moment's notice 24/7. And it's only 50 cents a day with no contracts. It's why The Verge calls SimpliSafe the best home security system. Go to simplisafe.com/team today and you'll get free shipping and a 60-day risk-free trial. You've got nothing to lose. Go now and be sure you go to simplisafe.com/team. That's simplisafe.com/team.
Well, it's great. Two really important points there is obviously you talked about mapping out the off-season in terms of a calendar of events, but also a calendar of training about those things, because you can manage it if you, again, have a plan. And I think we're obsessive about planning for the season. And sometimes when I talk to coaches, they're not as obsessive about the offseason. And that has to be planned, at least the things you control too. The other huge thing you said is you're not at your best every game. I mean, this is physiological stuff that it's like you cannot peak for every game. And you know that in triathlon, that you're trying to peak for the one major triathlon you want to prepare for that year. And the other ones, to a certain extent, are you want to be obviously at your best, but you're training through. And this type of concept. Can you talk about that a little bit in terms of the offseason? Because you don't need your NBA players to be at their best when they show up. You need them to be at their best October, as you said.
Listen, if they're at their best in July, I got problems, right? I mean, that's kind of the way it goes. So I think it's a real patience by the coach or trainer or whoever you're to not expect perfection every day, right? And I think that, you know, look, I was with Garnett for 20 years. The guy's a psychopath in terms of his work ethic and his, you know, I had to convince him it's okay. We don't feel great today. You know, you're not going to feel great every day. So I think that it's a patience and understanding from, again, the coaches. If they're looking really good in June, if they're looking really good in July, that's fine, but don't worry about the conditioning. You know, you know, these coaches run kids like crazy and then, okay, you got the next 3 weeks off. I mean, what do you think those kids are going to do? They're going to do nothing. So like, why are you so worried about running them? So I think that, and what the point you made is, it's not me proclaiming this. This is a physiological reality that, you know, you have to have peaks and valleys to your physical conditioning, whether it's a football player, a track and field athlete, a triathlete, a swimmer, whatever. I mean, you can't swim at your peak every meet, you know, throughout the whole year. So look, basketball coaches are a different breed. Coaches in general, they want to look great all the time. So I think it's understanding that during those summer off-season months that it's okay not to be at your best every day. And I think that that's tough. I think it's, I'm not proclaiming it to be easy, but I think that it's something that guys, you know, coaches really need to work on and understand how to plan that and let the players know. Look, you know, we've done work with guys' shots, Chris, and it's like, okay, you're going to shoot bad for 2 weeks, but I promise you on that third week, it'll all click because we've done it before. So those are the kind of expectations you got to set. Or if a guy's trying to change his body, you know, we're really working at it. Look, you're going to feel like crap for the first, you know, for a month. Like your body's just going to hurt. You know, we're stretching you in ways you haven't been stretched. We're adding weight. We're losing weight. We're changing. But, you know, these are the things that you have to expect. And then trust me, in that second month, you'll feel like $1 million. So those are the type of things that we really emphasize. And I think coaches can really emphasize that to their players to get the most out of them and not peak all the time. Again, I say all the time, we go to these summer league games in June and look at these kids going, I don't understand how anyone could think that this has anything to do with how they're going to play in January. You know, it's so far away. They're going to have time off. They just need to be, but if that same kid can't shoot the ball, or if that same kid isn't strong enough, that's the problem. Forget about how he played. You know, he probably, you know, who knows what he was thinking about that day. It's the middle of the summer, for God's sake, right? So, you know, let's make sure that we're addressing or assessing our players' off-season performances based on, are they getting better?
Well, you saying that helps everyone that listens to this hopefully understand that, again, you don't have to be your best in the summer. And that's not the point of true development, because true development, as you know, is this up and down cycle that you talked about, loading and unloading, and that process that goes through that. So I want to jump in quickly, because I'm sure you get asked about it as much as I do, specialization and your advice for young athletes in terms of basketball and specializing.
Yeah, I think that it's tough, you know, and I think it's getting earlier and earlier, right? I mean, again, I always use my personal experience. My son didn't have to, but once he made the varsity as a freshman, he dropped his other sports, right? Because it's just like an all-year-round deal. Up until eighth grade, though, he did football and different things, and we're glad he did. I think that it's the kids are specializing way too early. I think that I don't think you should, you know, athletes are athletes. Guys who are good are good. I think I know LeBron James was a wide receiver, you know, before he stopped playing when the basketball boomed in high school. So if you look at any of my great pro players, they were all multi-sport successful athletes, you know. So I don't think there's anything wrong with, I think there's so much benefit to playing multiple sports as a young player. I think that it's great playing some individual things or you know, something like a swimming where it's really you versus you and the competition, and then also playing some team sports, obviously basketball, baseball, and the different sports there are. It's a nice mixture for kids to grow in. The movements that are, you know, the actual movements that the players are doing are beneficial across sports. You know, I used to train Tommy Haas, the tennis player, and his favorite thing to do was shooting with lateral slides in between the shot. You know, he loved basketball. So, I mean, that's the same lateral slides he's doing baseline to baseline, hitting tennis balls back. So I think that there's a huge value in not specializing too early, but I also understand that once you get into high school and if you want to play on the varsity team or whatever, it's difficult to not be there for X amount of time. So I think that's really what parents have to do. The whole middle school thing up until high school, I wouldn't even think about specializing. You know, we say this to NBA guys all the time or potential pros, and it goes for fifth and sixth graders. If you're good, you're good. You know, you're going to be good. They're going to find you. You're not going to not be good because you played soccer one season in the sixth grade. You know, I think the pressure of parents to make sure their kid is doing everything he can to get that college scholarship and or start on the high school team. And, you know, and again, I think parents today they don't even want their kid to play JV as a freshman. You know, it's like, that's not good enough. They want you to go in as a freshman. And you know, back when we were in high school, that was just what you did. You know, you played freshman and you played JV and occasionally you get bumped up to the varsity. Right. So now it's this, let's get it all by the time we're in the seventh and eighth grade, let's get ranked, you know, while we're in the seventh grade, which is a whole different topic of kind of craziness that goes on. So I think specialization, I do understand when you get into high school and you're a sophomore and you're on the varsity team, you know, unless you're a stud at a different sport, I would encourage you to try to do it. And if the coach is good with it, great. But I do understand, like, the whole football season, you're not working on your game. You know, there's been many football players that are good basketball players that had to specialize, but that's not until their 10th, 11th, you know, grade years, because and Michael Wilson, the wide receiver at Stanford, was a great basketball player he played his freshman, sophomore, and senior year, because that junior year he just had to focus on, you know, his off-season training to get to Stanford. You know, the guy's a top receiver at Stanford now, so I get it. But then he returned to play as a senior in high school, you know, because he enjoyed it. He loved the game. So I would specialize as little as possible and based on what your coach would allow you to do. But I think it's great to play multiple sports.
Great stuff. And I'm not sure where you stand on it. I get frustrated watching either from a player development warm-up or watching team warm-up. And it's coming back to this integration that you've talked about. So much of warm-up is psychological as much as it is physiological. And I just see such low engagement and almost boredom in warm-up from doing, you know, again, repetitive, mindless things. Do you have a philosophy on warm-up now that you found best practices that you can share with us?
You mean for a game or for just in training in general?
Training in general, but you can make it game specific if you want. I get frustrated watching both, to be honest. I don't think we haven't evolved warm-up much, even though we have all this knowledge of sports science. It hasn't really changed much in the last 4 years. Layup lines, you know, all these different things that happen, you know, are really, again, low physiological and low psychological engagement.
Right. Well, and listen, I was watching at a game yesterday in the NBA level, and there's guys, you know, laying on the floor getting stretched before half our shooting. Yeah. I mean, I think that my blanket statement there would be, you have to have a routine, and your routine has to lead to letting you start your practice, your game, your training session in the right state of mind and physically warmed up. So, you know, of course we promote dynamic warm-up flexibility stuff. You know, we prefer, you know, we've never do static stretching before a workout or stretch. I think that, you know, getting the guys engaged. So another Kevin Garnett's story is that, you know, Kevin would never come out early to the games to shoot. You know, a lot of guys come out, shoot early, do a little routine, and they go back in the locker room and come out. And the reason he didn't is because, you know, he was so intense that he would be exhausted, you know, for the game. So when Kevin came out for the regular warmups, he had to change his uniform off and before the game because it was just so sweaty. And that's the kind of intensity that he brought into every game. So I think coaches have to find a way to engage the players and convince them that. But again, you know, it's funny because you look at games and you watch the warm-up and the coaches are all sitting on the bench talking to each other and the guys are doing their warm-up. So it goes both ways. I mean, the intensity has to come from the staff. You know, it has to, players have to understand that 15 minutes or 10 minutes or 20 minutes, however long it is really, really important. And in terms of a practice warm-up, I mean, you know, we all know the old sit around in a circle, stretch, and kind of shoot the breeze about what happened in school today type of warm-up. You know, I would and that's probably what you're referring to. And it's just, you know, you can't warm up. There should be some sort of gradual, you know, increase in intensity to get you ready to play at a high, high level in practice through a game. So I think a routine, but I also think that shortening it up and making it, hey, we're not going to stay out here for 30 minutes. We're going to get a good, strong 10-minute warm-up, and this is the routine. Not so much for the game. You might have a little longer, but I'm talking about for practice. You know, do your warm-up, add some ball handling drills to your warm-up, add some, you know, some shooting drills. Make the warm-up your skill work. You know what I mean? Make guys get right into it instead of putting skill work last. Start the practice with skill work. Let them get a sweat going on. Because again, you're playing with the player's mentality. Who doesn't like working on their shooting? You know, that's like, you know, if you start with defense and, you know, I don't want to do that. But if you warm up and you do your dynamic warm up and then you get right into shooting drills right away, I think guys will go hard. Because I think that if the coaches are setting the right tone, because that's something they like to do. So it is a problem. And I think that it just really requires a constant attention. The warm up and the routine is equally as important as the game plan. You know, that's kind of the way we look at it.
But three things I want to reemphasize for coaches, and I'll start one that I want you to come back to and say it again. But you talked about individualization, Garnett story. Like, warmups tend to be this group function, and I get that we're a team and we have to play as a team, but warmup I find is so individual. And certain players, I assume, according to your philosophy, it should be okay that they do something different. Maybe not everything different, but they should be okay doing stuff different because they would warm up differently. So there's that individualization component. The other part that you said, which is, again, so important, is make your warm-up your skill work. It doesn't have to be this 20-minute, which is too long. So many warm-ups are too long. It doesn't have to be this 20-minute period of dynamic work without a ball. I love that you said make your warm-up your skill work. And then the last one, which I want you to talk about quickly, is no static stretching before. I mean, this physiological evidence has existed for a long time, but I'm sure you still see it a lot, because I do.
Yeah, I mean, we kind of got rid of that years ago. You know, I had a great opportunity when I first left IMG to Open Impact. I worked with Mark Verstegen from Athletes Performance, which is now Exos. And, you know, Mark's great in the field, and you know, that whole dynamic flexibility taking the place of static stretching. I mean, that was in 2006 or 2007. We haven't done any. I mean, stretching is great afterwards, but basically you're putting the muscles to sleep. You're laying on, you know, you got guys laying on the ground. There's nothing wrong with stretching like in the locker room before the game or, you know, but that whole, once you get out there, once you get going, that whole sit around in a circle and, you know, do butter for the captain calls out the different stretches. I mean, we haven't done that in a long time. Now, there is a place for that, for static stretching. Absolutely. But not to get your, so basically you're putting your body to sleep to warm up is basically what's happening. So that's why we've switched to a lot of dynamic stuff. And we've been so creative where we, you know, mini bands are huge what we're doing now. So, you know, you do some lateral, glutes are underutilized and it's causing a lot of injuries. Guys are quad dominant jumpers, too much tension on the knee. You know, we warm the glutes up with a mini band routine. You know, again, we have a video series online that we have a whole routine you can do just with mini bands. The coach, they're $2 each. So if you can afford, you got 15 players, you got $30 invested, and they could do a really great dynamic warm up with mini bands that are going to engage your glutes, fire the glutes, make sure you're jumping properly, and the guys will be sweating like crazy. So yeah, we've gotten away from that static stuff a long time ago. Thanks. Again, only beforehand. I afterwards, guys get stretched, which I think is you know, is valuable.
Yeah, post exercise recovery, regeneration, certainly active recovery, but also, as you said, this passive stretching, which is again, most of the literature points towards that being very beneficial in terms of that and cool down and recovery, whatever you want to call it. So coach, maybe quickly, a few things. What player habits do you see that kind of drive you crazy that are highly changeable?
That are highly changeable?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I just think that drilling at anything but game speed is so easy to correct. You know, I mean, you're not going to go out there and go gung-ho all the time. You got to warm up, and I get it. But, you know, I watch guys do workouts, and, you know, again, my son's in college now. He's involved with the program, and I watch guys – I'm watching a lot more college basketball this year than I have, because usually I just watch players that we're going to get for the draft. But now that I'm a little more interested in some different things, I just see so many guys. You know, I go into gyms and watch kids working out all the time, and it's just that – that 70, 60, 50% effort in workouts is like, I just don't get it. I mean, it's so changeable. It's something you can control. And, you know, guys will come off of a pin down or trail on a jog and make a shot. Well, when you get in the game and there's a guy on your heels and, you know, you're sprinting down the court and there's 10 seconds to go or even in the middle of a game, you're moving a lot faster, you know. So you just have to drill at game speed. So if you simplify it again, if you say do things at game speed and things you're going to do in the game, that's how you want to drill. Now, again, there's all ball handling drills and all that kind of stuff you do separately. But once you get into the drilling of a core part of a workout, do it at game speed. Even in practice, our coaches are trying. They're trying to get shots up. They're trying to do things. You watch them and you got the one kid rebounding for the other kid and he kind of throws the ball back halfway and, you know, bounces it. And it's like, it makes me crazy, you know, to say, you know, you could use the same 10 minutes and get in some really, as a matter of fact, instead of doing 20, do 10 minutes and just go game speed, you know. And that's, we've changed our workouts a lot the last couple of years. And even in maybe last, as we've progressed, so much has gotten to be shorter time span with more game speed. So, you know, it's something that we really have focused on. So that drives me crazy. And I think it's changeable.
Yeah, it's very changeable. And yeah, the phrase workload management is obviously thrown around a lot. But in terms of workouts and stuff, are players more conscious of their workloads now because of the, you know, bringing in all the wearable technologies and all the different things? Or do they, by and large, they trust that you're doing the right thing for them, obviously, but they trust the data that you're showing them as well, I imagine?
Yeah, I think most of the players fight the load management stuff. You know, I think that they would, they do trust me and they trust the sports scientists, but I think that, you know, look, again, this is year 25 for me. I mean, if you two told me 15 years ago that, or 10 years ago that Chauncey Billups was going to take a game off for load management, we'd all be like, huh? You know, it didn't even make any sense. So I think that they're more conscious of it for sure. I think that they fight it, you know, more than they embrace it. And they do understand, again, when you talk about load management from a pro standpoint, when you're talking about a business decision, right? Lengthening someone's career out 2 more years on a deal could be worth $10 million X and so forth. When you talk about from a young player, it's longevity. And, you know, you talk about young players in college getting injured more, high school players getting injured more. Is it, you know, you've seen all the arguments of, is it too many AAU games or club games, whatever you want to call them, in the off season? Is it too much? So I think load management in what we call it today is basically what I was saying earlier, having a plan and being sensible about how much pounding you're putting on your body. But they do fight it. You know, who doesn't want to play more, right? So they do fight it. But I think that the technology has made everyone much more aware of it.
Maybe some advice to coaches in season strength and conditioning. You mentioned this earlier. I think somewhat we're a little bit over the top with some of the conditioning work, whereas playing basketball and practicing basketball is conditioning, and it's conditioning specific to the game if you're doing it right. So maybe less so the conditioning and more the weight. What are some best practices to be able to either maintain or continue with strength within the season?
I think that like what I would say as a general to coaches is like a 2-day-a-week total body lift. Not pushing maximum weights, but just keeping the muscles fresh, finding 2 days. Usually most high schools have 2 games a week at the most, I would think. Maybe some of them might have a little more, but I think that that's a, we're talking about a 30 to 40 minute lift. And let's say if you take it 40, you're probably lifting a circuit type workout for 20 to 25 minutes and then stretching and foam rolling after that. So I really encourage coaches to try to stay on a 2-day-a-week lifting plan in season and just make them short. Not, you know, incredibly intense, but engaging the core, engaging the glutes, and you know, hopefully they have someone there that can design something effective for them that's going to keep guys strong, but also, you know, not wear them down.
That's great. And have you found before or after practice, which one is best, or separate from practice? Is there a best strategy?
I think that it goes down to what the coach is looking for. So if you have a practice, you got a nail, I would do the lift after practice, you know, because you get the guys are going to be, you know, just by the law of fatigue, a little bit more tired. If you really have a lift, like if that day is the focal point, the lift. So there's always a give and take. So if you lift, you can't have everything great. I mean, and every weightlifting coach and strength coach has been there where they're sitting there waiting to lift the team after practice and the coach runs the practice long and then the team is terrible and he can't do what he wanted to do because they were too fatigued. And the strength coach can't really say anything because it's not really his place. I mean, we've all been there, right? We've seen those guys. So I think that it would be great to coordinate when the lift is based on the importance of the practice. So if the coach says, look, you take them first 25 minutes, 30 minutes, 35 minutes, and then we're just going to shoot today, that's great. You know, like on a little bit of a low day, if he says, hey, we got a lot of stuff to get in today, we're going to lift after. I think that might be the better way.
That's a great point. One of your pillars you talked about, which is mental side, integration of mental skills. So what are some specific things that you do to be able to integrate mental skills within workouts?
Yeah, I think we just challenge them during the workouts. You know, I think that's the thing we do, you know, whether it's shooting where you got to make three in a row to move to the next spot. You know, I think those are great things. We make drills maybe a little more difficult than they should be. We put some running in between, you know, to cause fatigue, to see how they react. And then, you know, I've changed drill work up a lot where we put a defender on and just say, okay, once you're fatigued, it's just, you're going one-on-one with the defender and just making them make decisions when they're tired. So it's really trying to put them into situations that will strain their brain and see how they react and work on it. And then from a technical standpoint, it's more of a, you know, in film, teaching them how to watch the film, teaching them how to evaluate their own game, you know, and how to prepare mentally for the next time based on the mistakes they've seen. So there's kind of a cerebral side and then like a practical side where you're in there, you're tired, you got to make decisions. The workout is straining your brain. You know, those are some things that we really think are very important. So both of them are important.
That's great. And then do you give them some coping strategies or do you teach them coping strategies or encouraging them to use them when they're, say they're breaking down or say they're struggling? Are there some specific things that you help them with in terms of those?
We do, you know, just like things like one play at a time and how to focus on what's ahead of you and not worry about, you know, missing shots. And we have draft guys that come in and you go into a draft workout with the Houston Rockets and they have you shoot, you know, from five spots for a minute and they're going to count how many you make. Well, you start off, you know, 2 for 10, you got to be able to bounce out of that. So you just, you know, we tell someone if you're making the best out of 10 and you're 2 for 4, you know, your mindset has to be, well, I can still be 8 for 10, not, oh crap, I'm 2 for 4. I just started. So yeah, those are the type of things we really work with players on, especially when they're going to be put in draft situations. And even from a high school kid, you know, you miss your first 4 shots of the game. How do you cope with that? How do you get out of that? You got to, you know, I used to work out Reggie Miller and Reggie would miss his like first 10 shots and they would hit the side of the backboard and he just started nailing them. You know, he never even thought about it. Right. So it's something that I think that I've had great experience with the guys who have done it at the highest level to be able to, you know, relay to guys coming up and saying, here's how you cope with this. Here's the kind of things that should be going through. I mean, it's no different than, you know, what anyone would do in terms of positive thinking and different terms that people have used. I have a great respect for all that stuff. And again, we go back to that individuality. Every guy is different. You know, some guys, you probably seen players, Chris, that, you know, are 12 years old and you're like, man, that guy is putting it up when he catches it. He doesn't care, you know? And then there's other kids that miss one shot and won't shoot again the rest of the game. You know, that's just, you can't explain why. But you got to teach each of those two people how to deal with what they're dealing with individually.
Super stuff. And coach, I can't thank you enough for taking time to be able to share with us. Coaches, I can't encourage you enough to go to impactbball.com to be able to check out coaches' resources, coach and trainer curriculum specific to obviously a lot of the coaches that be listening, but the players' programs as well to help them be able to train year round. Coach, anything else you want to share about the stuff that you do? Obviously there's in-person training as well available, but anywhere you want to direct coaches to learn more?
No, I mean, I think our videos, we filmed our videos to be, you know, really practical for coaches to use. broken it down, and our summer camps are great, and what you know, anything we can offer would be, you know, something that we can, you know, if you go to our website, there's a ton of different things that we can have on there. But we enjoy training players of all ages and coaches, and anything we can do to help, coaches can feel free to reach out to our website, to me, my email's on there, any questions anyone might have.
That's great. And I've seen you in clinic a few times, and wonderful to be able to talk to you in person. So again, thanks for taking the time.
Okay, Chris, thank you.
Basketball Immersion has grown, and I'm happy to say we can now support other coaches in providing access to their intellectual property. We created bivideoproductions.com to support the game, to help us all learn the game to deeper and deeper levels through our bivideoproductions.com platform. On bivideoproductions.com, you can now find all access practices for Doug Novak and Dave Smart, full clinic videos for Best in the West Clinic featuring Alex Sarama, Mike McKay, and Jorik Michaels, and Aaron Ferns tagging up offensive rebounding system. Go to bivideoproductions.com for more details and all these videos and what is coming soon.
To find out more about Coach and all we spoke about today, please take a look at the show notes for today's episode. I love to share the game and have basketball coaching conversations, so connect with me on social media. You can find all my social media information and all your membership, clinic, and consulting needs at basketballimmersion.com. That concludes today's episode. I know there are so many podcasts out there. Thank you for taking the time to listen to the Basketball Podcast with me, your host, Chris Oliver. Please subscribe and share the podcast with your friends and colleagues so that we can keep bringing you the best of what's out there and share the game.